Wikimania 2006 presentation by David Weinberger. What's happening to knowledge? This recording is provided to you by wikizine.org. News for and about the Wikimedia community.
Let me turn to my topic today. I'm here to talk with you about knowledge. So, thank you. So I have this ridiculous topic that I gave myself. I can't blame anybody. So, and I need to try to narrow it, but instead it kept sprawling and it continued to sprawl. So, and as I go on, I'm going to get more and more speculative and sort of airheaded. Just want to let you know. Now, there's also a tremendous act of cowardice in this presentation in that throughout the entire thing, the shadow of NPOV, which I thought until this afternoon when I heard Jimmy at the session refer to it as NPOV, I thought all the cool kids called it NPOV. Nevertheless, NPOV hangs over this talk, the question of what constitutes knowledge. John Riegel just came from a talk John Riegel gave that was brilliant and was wonderful and that provided a framework for talking about this. And that's what we need, because this is, as you know, more than anybody, this is a huge topic, and it's actually at the very center of not just the value of Wikipedia, but its potential going forward. I'll just tell you in a sentence, the problem that I have, and I think many of us have with the concept of neutrality, neutral point of view, and this is both the problem with the neutral point of view and what gives rise to the need for it, is that as a set of world cultures, we are really forked. It's just really difficult to imagine how we are going to be able to continue without forking. But that is exactly the challenge. And that's something that, as I say, is behind much of what I'm going to say, but I don't address it head on because it's too hard and I'm frightened of it. So I want to go through very quickly seven properties of traditional knowledge. These are the traditional properties of knowledge. And then come back to five of them and look at not only what's happening with Wikipedia in this regard, but more generally with knowledge. And as I say, this is way too big a topic, but what the heck. So the first property is that we've assumed traditionally that knowledge is a three-term relationship, knower, known, and knowledge. And in fact, traditionally, knowledge started out as the place where mind and world met. It was the thing between. It was the answer to the question, how do we know? It's the process of knowing the world. Over the course of time, over the past 2,500 years, and I should say I'm only talking about Western ideas, that's the only thing I know anything about, over the course of time, we've managed to tell ourselves that, in fact, knowledge is in our own brains. It's in our skulls, which is a deeply wrong mistake, as many have pointed out. But a second property of traditional knowledge is that we have assumed there is one knowledge. Can't pluralize it. There's one knowledge, and it's the same for everyone, just as there's one real world, and it's the same for everyone. Third property is that, therefore, knowledge about the world is binary. It's true or it's false. And if you have if you view the world over as on that side, the right side, you're just wrong. Something's gone wrong. You're taking bad drugs. There's one way. And so stuff is either true or false. Aristotle's law of the excluded middle, things can't both be and not be the same. You know what I mean. That was actually law of non-contradiction, which is related. So, next property of traditional knowledge is that it doesn't matter who says it. Because of all this, it doesn't matter how you put it, what language it's in, what your accent is, if you talk funny or not, it doesn't matter what words you use. It's true no matter who says it. And this abstracts the personal from knowledge in ways that are both beneficial and, from my point of view, deadly, but that's a different question. Next characteristic of knowledge, not really that it's simple, but that it's simpler than the world that it explains. We have the looming buzzing confusion of the world, of our perceptions, of our ideas of it, of our opinions, our beliefs, and then there's knowledge. It's simpler than the world it explains. Of course, it's not really simple, but it's simpler. And this means that the next property of knowledge is that most things simply aren't knowledge. That's why we need knowledge, and in a world that's even moderately complex, we also need experts to help us sort, or traditional view, right? We need to sort through what is and isn't knowledge, and most stuff just isn't. Most of it doesn't make it into the basket. Sixth property is that we've assumed it's orderly. And some very traditional orders, hierarchical orders like this, trees, are incredibly powerful ways of organizing ideas. it turns out that the basic idea of ordering that we've used for knowledge, whether it's a tree or not, but quite typically it is a tree, is the paradigm of knowledge, that we've assumed that things have one place. Everything has its place as one place. That place is known and decided by experts, and so we build up a framework. Now, the fact that this is exactly the same set of principles that we use for sorting and ordering our laundry is not a coincidence. We've ordered ideas using the same principles of organization that we've used for organizing physical things. That is a tremendous limitation that gets lifted from us as we move online, as all the information moves on online. That's what we're doing now. That's what we're inventing and living through now. That's one of the reasons why this is so damn important. It's a big change. And seventh and final property I want to point to is that we've assumed that knowledge is bigger than us. So this is Francis Mixa, who teaches at the University of Texas, Austin, who is disputing this traditional view, but he puts it rather well. And the idea is that we've assumed that knowledge is like this large realm that's transgenerational. It's bigger than, that is bigger than all of us, that we can contribute to. If we work really hard and we get our doctorate and we maybe we can write something that will be added by the filterers to this transgeneration body of knowledge, which we can leave for our children, and is a glorious thing that we built. Knowledge is bigger than we are. It is not at all a coincidence that many of these properties are exactly the same properties as properties of the real world. In part, that's because we've assumed that knowledge is a mirror of the real world. And so it takes on some of the formal properties. But it's not only because of that. It's also to a large degree because the means that we've had for aggregating knowledge, for communicating it, for preserving it, for teaching it, have been books, have been physical objects. And books have to go in one place on the shelf, not lots of them. And books they have to have covers. They have to be about something. And the something is what gets put between the covers. And sure, there are links between the books. There are footnotes. But if you've ever been in the Harvard Library, in the Widener Library, one of the best libraries in the world, if you find a reference in a book and you want to go find the book itself, you have to walk up and down through alleys, over hills, over dales, through bridges. You have to ask directions four times. It's as if they're trying to make it as hard as possible to put two ideas together. That's just the nature of space. It's just the nature of books. It's just the way it is. So I'm totally torn. I'm with Brewster Kahle. I'm as close to a saint as we get on the web on this. I love books. On the other hand, they are a huge pain in the ass. And one of the things that they do is force us into putting things between covers. Because that's what that's what a book is. So now I want to go back over some of these points. So first is that we've assumed that knowledge is in our heads, which is just this bizarre idea. So let's say that you have discovered a gnat, and you want to know, we're talking about knowledge here, you want to know what that gnat is, and let's say there's some controversy. How do you resolve it? Well, you go down the street to the Harvard Museum, where you will find 1,000 cabinets in an air-conditioned, controlled environment with 25 or so trays in each with lots of little bugs in them. And some of the bugs have little red labels on them, and you can see on those labels the information that, so it's a shish-kebab thing, right? You got the bug, in that case, that bug was from 1869. So it's a 150-year-old bug. I'm a humanities major, so that's an approximation. You got a bug, you got a pin, and you got some labels in this little shish kebab. And part of the shish kebab is crucial. If it's a red label, that means it's a type specimen, which means it's the original goddamn bug that the naturalist found when he or she, and very likely he, discovered that it was in 1869. Oh, new bug! It's the actual bug. So that doesn't do you any good if you don't have the metadata. And the metadata is red, so it's a type specimen, which collection it's in, where it was found, and then that number, 1212 in this case. That's a pointer. That's a pointer to a ledger. The ledger is one of six that's kept in a filing cabinet a few doors down in a professor's office. He's the latest in a chain of curators who are responsible for handwriting into this ledger the number, sequential number, and the name of the new organism. This, a chain of people protecting this knowledge. So what does it take to know a gnat? Is this something that's in our heads? No! It takes, for example, air conditioners.
air conditioners do not fit in our heads. It takes a set of institutions. It takes dedicated people, experts, who devote their life to the care and trust of taking care of the ledgers. It takes a system of metadata. It takes pins. It takes dried out husks of bugs kept whole for 150 years. That's what it takes to know a gnat. It's not in our heads. Knowledge is not and never was in our heads. And the notion that we keep insisting that we live as if knowledge is in our heads, that we feel knowledge weighing down in our skulls, that we think about experts or people who have all this stuff in their heads, when we know when we go to the museum that that's not how it works, our insistence on believing this is pathological. But we're getting away from it. Well, of course, all of this now is Harvard's putting it all online. And so we will have a database of DNA at some point in the not near future, a database of DNA that will enable us to know a gnat. And so the appliances required to know a gnat will change, but we will still need the institutions, the people, the technology, the material. Which means also, by the way, that knowledge can't possibly be a mirror. That metaphor doesn't even begin to work in this environment. Next is that knowledge is simpler than the world it explains. In May, I actually didn't intend that. In May, President Bush gave a talk about immigration. And it was about 2,500 words long. And we know that all presidential addresses like this are carefully worked over by the presidential speechwriters who make sure that it's expressed simply, that the mandate over and over is, we've got to keep it simple, boil it down. American people will understand that. That's too complex. Boil it, you know. And so it's exactly the same thing that marketers do until you get it down to something that, so simple. Well, we're actually pretty sick, I think, of the simplification. And one of the things that you see is that within a few hours after this 2,500-word speech was given, there were over 2,500 blog posts about it. And every one of those blog posts was, I didn't look at them all, so I'm, generalizing, but I'm quite confident that almost every one of them, in one way or another, complicated what the speechwriters had tried to make simple. Because that's what we do. It's what we do as bloggers, right? You get an idea, you find something somebody else has written, and you sort of turn it around in your hand, you look at the bottom, you say, well, do you notice this dent here? That's really it. I wonder what did that? And you blog about it. Which is exactly what we do in conversation. That's all we do in conversation. We iterate upon difference. We find something in common, we're both looking at the same rock, and we iterate on the differences. And that's what we do in blogs. Well, that's a great movement towards complexity. Towards complexifying the simple, which is a tremendous joy, especially after 100 years of being made stupid by simplification. And there's always this dialectic. I mean, anybody who teaches knows this absolutely. Because what do? You try to simplify things for your students, and as soon as they're starting to understand it, you say, well, that's not all there is. Then you complexify it. That's what you do, and that's a really useful dialectic. Well, this dialectic has taken, and it's actually a good term to use here, because there's something Hegelian about what I'm about to say. All right, so we have this movement, and along come hyperlinks. And hyperlinks are, in almost a Hegelian sense, a way out of and above that yet encapsulates, the both sides. The need to simplify, because we need to do that, and the need to complexify, because that's so interesting. That's where we live, is in the complexification. With hyperlinks, we can do that. Every sentence has a hyperlink in Wikipedia. I know that's not true, but it's not a bad approximation. It's a huge number. Every chance you can get, the ethos is hyperlink it. And so you have something that no longer fits between covers, even the stuff that's between covers, so to speak. It's within a single article on a topic. You have so many ways out of it, pointing out of it, just a click away. You can navigate the entire Wikipedia just by following the hyperlinks. That adds a layer of complexity at the user's control, user's discretion, that is incredibly powerful and incredibly liberating and breaks the old book model. And of course, obviously, it's not just Wikipedia does this. The power of hyperlinks is what's built the web. I mean, literally built the web. No links, no web. Next of the traditional points is that everything has its place. Well, hyperlinks already sort of get at that, but this is Mortimer Adler, who was very important in the history of modern history of the Britannica. He's a philosopher, did the Great Book series, and then he did the the drawing together of all the ideas in the great books and relating them. So, and likewise, Brewster Kahle talked about the Propedia, the section of the Britannica that does the same thing, tries to pull together the ideas. You read his memoirs, and maybe I'm just reading it this way, but it sounds like a lifetime fighting against the evils of alphabetization. He hated alphabetization, and he's at an encyclopedia, which is an issue. And he hated it because, it's not how he puts it, but how I put it, alphabetizing something adds no information to it. Right? Adds no information, whereas doing a nice, linking things or doing a tree does. It adds a lot of information. This is not the first time by far that anybody has railed against alphabetization. In fact, it's been that way from the very beginning of alphabetizing. It wasn't just the French Encyclopedia that faced this scandal, but it is one of them, where some theologians were very upset because the French Encyclopedia was alphabetizing and thus demeaning God's order. You're flattening it, dudes. You're losing some of the information that's there. So there was an outcry, and the encyclopedists did produce a tree-like version, a taxonomy. And right there under religion, they put religion on the same branch as superstition. Thus, perhaps not satisfying those who were upset about it, but that's the price you pay. If you're going to do this type of ordering, if you're going to choose one order, then somebody's going to be unhappy. And in this case, they made their choice. Well, Wikipedia has nobody uses it alphabetically. Again, an overstatement. I'm so worried about overstatements. I am totally non-fact-driven. I am not fact-based, and I know with whom I'm speaking. So, as far as I know, the alphabetical view of Wikipedia is not a tremendously used one, and you'll correct me later if I'm wrong. Why would you? It's just, instead, you can search and then you can navigate the hyperlinks, or you can use the category system. And the category system is, it seems to me, a little underdeveloped. Nevertheless, it expresses something really important. So this is the equivalent of tagging outside of Wikipedia, where readers, editors, readers within Wikipedia get to categorize things the way that they want. This is the beginning of a folksonomy. That is a hugely powerful technique, precisely because it allows people to organize and connect ideas the way that they want to, without having to make a decision that this is the way of doing it. Now, there may be neutral point of view possible about facts, something I would argue with you about. I can't imagine that there's a neutral point of view even possible, even considerable, about taxonomy. Okay, we can talk about that later. Okay, next point is the binary nature of knowledge. Things are true or false. So, okay, I want to be really careful here because I've been really badly misquoted while trying to be extremely careful in saying the following. Okay? If you open up a copy of, say, Britannica, World Book, whatever, let's say Britannica, you are right to believe that what you read is credible. Something gets credibility simply by being in Britannica. That is not to say that it's necessarily true. I'm just saying that there's credibility because of the processes that you know correctly that they've gone through in trying to vet their information and so forth. So something in Britannica, that is evidence that it's credible. Not perfect. Am I safe so far? Okay. Something, if you open up Wikipedia randomly, you don't, simply by being in Wikipedia, something does not have credibility. Simply by being in Wikipedia. Now, let me hasten to add, things have credibility in Wikipedia. Wikipedia has credibility. But simply because you may hit the article at the very moment that some asshole has turned it into fiction. So simply being there doesn't give you anything except sort of probabilistic sense of credibility. So, things obviously in Wikipedia have credibility. Why do they? How do we make this decision? Well, you thought about this more than I have, but it's things like, if it's a major article, you probably already know something about it, so if there's something wildly wrong, you're likely to catch it. It's also more likely to have been heavily edited, and thus many of the errors to have been driven out, and some interesting new ones driven in, perhaps. You can check the discussion page to see, and discussion pages are just an amazing artifact. You can actually see how these decisions were made, and that is an additional reason why an article has credibility in Wikipedia. And then my same favorite thing about it, which is Wikipedia is not shy about putting up notices about its own fallibility. In fact, there's a list, as you know, this is a small section of it, a fraction of it. There's a list of all the different ways an encyclopedia can go wrong. And Wikipedia encourages readers, editors, to post, to say blatantly, here's how this article may be wrong, here's why you should not give this your full belief. That makes Wikipedia more credible. Its willingness to admit its fallibility makes it more credible. Of course it does. For one thing, it tells us that you're really interested in helping us get the truth. So the question, there's something wrong with the question I'm about to ask, but I'm going to ask it anyway. The question is, why is it that Wikipedia is so easy about letting users insert these, whereas you will never, I don't believe in my lifetime, ever see those types of notices. So there's a really important question about why not? Why wouldn't they do this? Now, the subtler sort of discussion that that my question masks is, well, of course, newspapers and even more than encyclopedias do, but newspapers actually do have a variety of types of metadata that flag how much you should believe it. If it's on the op-ed page, that's silent metadata that it's belief, not knowledge. They'll say according to sources and so forth. So there is sort of semantics of backing off, but it's not very blatant, and they want to hide it. And they won't put these sorts of things here. I reluctantly conclude because there are economic and personal reasons why traditional authorities are more interested in being perceived as authorities than they are in leading us the truth. All I want to say about the idea, the traditional idea that knowledge is bigger than us, is that if you were the proverbial Martian and you wanted to get a sense of what humans are interested in, you certainly could go to the Britannica and get the 65,000 topics that are there, but actually only a fairly small percentage of those are anybody actually interested in. They're mainly class assignments that we do. If you wanted a better sense, you should go to Wikipedia, and there you will see, for better and certainly for worse, the sorts of things that humans are interested in. This is a reflection, a better reflection of us. In fact, I think it's really important. I'm sorry, I'll go back to this style just for one slide. It's really important to us readers, as well as to editors, that Wikipedia feels like ours. It's something that we've done. We've done this. We did this. And not just the people in this room, although I understand the curve of contributors. Nevertheless, when you read Wikipedia, you know it's ours. And too much, for too long, for thousands of years, we've been alienated from knowledge because it's been presented as theirs. They're theirs. I'm sorry, you have the degree? I don't think so. Knowledge comes from there. You got the credential? No, sorry. You don't get into that realm. They get to talk to you. They're the authorities. That is deeply alienating. Wikipedia, not deeply alienating, because it's ours. We did this. Okay, so now I'm going to get really speculative. The idea that there's one truth that's the same in everyone's voice, this is a really... Wikipedia is intersecting the culture on this in a really useful way, but I don't want to talk about Wikipedia too directly here, except to begin. So, you'll tell me if I'm wrong. I'm imagining that there is a sort of typical curve to the editing, that new articles, especially fairly visible articles, go through a time when they're heavily edited, and then the editing falls off, and it sort of asymptotically goes to steady state. Am I really wrong in that? I'm really wrong. It depends. Excellent. Okay. Then let me continue and let me show you where I'm going in the sentence and tell me if I'm really wrong, in which case I still have to continue because I've got PowerPoints. So. So my idea is this, that look ahead 10 years. I am guessing that in some way, there'll always be additions and alterations and improvements and corrections and arguments and discussion. But that in some sense, the big chunks of the big articles, however you define that, they're going to be sort of stable. They're going to be sort of done. We will have the one on calcium. The calcium entry is going to be pretty stable. And there's going to be, there will be, of course, sort of fringy sorts of changes and updates. But, well, we did the calcium one. Let's move on now to hydrogen. You know, whatever. The big ones are going to be done. And if that's the case, okay, so I'm going to continue as if you agreed. Basic teaching technique. So, this is the 1868 World Almanac. It was created to a large degree in order to be able to commoditize facts, to put facts into a single book so that journalists could have them on their desk and not have to worry about chasing down these basic facts, but instead could do their higher value work and have the facts at their fingertips. And it worked. And almanacs generally now, they don't compete on the facts, they compete on the organization of the facts and their timeliness and stuff like that. The basic facts are available to all the almanacs equally, which is more or less the definition of a commodity. So facts have been commoditized. Now, commodities are not necessarily not worth the salt, salt itself being, of course, a commodity. You know, nails are commodities, too. And if you pulled out all of the nails, because they're just commodities, in the world, a lot of things would fall down. So commodities are really important. And by commoditizing facts, we are able to move up a level in our thinking, in our work. Well, so here's, I told you, I'm getting speculative. So what I want to suggest is that we may be in the process of commoditizing knowledge, and particularly doing that in Wikipedia. That is, coming up with a set of things that basically, here's what we agree on. This is stuff we don't have to argue about anymore, because we already agreed on what the atomic weight of calcium is. That's in there. So let's move on. That we are doing to knowledge what the almanac did to facts, and that's really useful because it enables us to move our efforts up a level. So this is Martin Heidegger. It's 1927. He's a German philosopher, he wrote Being and Time in 1927. I understand that Wittgenstein is a much cooler philosopher to reference. For one thing, Wittgenstein was not a Nazi son of a bitch. So he has that going for him. But Heidegger said something that was really, I think, he said a bunch of things I think were really useful and true. And so this is one of them. He asked, well, what does it mean to be something? Let's take a prosaic thing. Let's take a hammer, sort of the canonical example. And he's not thinking about, well, what would it mean to be a hammer if we were on Mars, or if we were fish and only had fins and couldn't hold them? He wanted to know, just what's a hammer? Here's the thing. What's this? It's a hammer. What does it do? Okay, that's the sense. So what does it mean to be a hammer? In order to explain this, to know what a hammer is, you have to know about nails. In this culture, you've got to know about nails, which means you also have to know about boards, which means you also have to know about lumber, which means you have to know about trees, and thus about forests, and thus about the economic system that connects those things, and the sun and the moon. You've got to know the whole thing. And you can call this whole thing a context, which is true but a little bloodless. You can call it intelligibility, which is really bloodless and puts all of this into the realm of reason, which is, I think, a mistake. Or you can do what Heidegger did and say, well, no, what we're talking about is a realm of meaning. And by meaning, we mean this inchoate, inarticulatable mass of references, of relationships that allow things to emerge and to have meaning. So if that's what we're going to call meaning, then I want to speculatively suggest this. Andrew Clark, in a book called Being There, says something that is really obvious as soon as he says it, which is the best sort of thing. He says, you know, we as a species, we've always externalized consciousness, functions of consciousness. So writing externalizes memory, and books externalize knowledge, and calculators now have externalized arithmetic to the dismay of elementary school teachers. So this is something we do, and it's tremendously valuable. It's how we progress as a species, right? We externalize this stuff. So maybe what we're doing now is externalizing meaning. And what I mean is, we're spending a lot of time together in this room, but all around the world, putting things together, making connections between all these pieces now that are available digitally in the connected world. We're doing it through tagging at sites like Delicious and Flickr and the rest of them. No, we're adding tags and we're letting things connect. And when we add tags for one reason, they're permanent, they're public, and so they connect in ways even that we didn't intend. In fact, Mitch Kapoor has, you're working, you've blogged about this, right? So, has a really interesting alpha, pre-alpha thing going on of gathering tags and then finding meaning in them that was not intended necessarily by the individual who created the tags. Did I just disclose anything untoward? Okay. Bam! We're going to put them together, put things together, make these connections in hierarchies, traditional trees, because they're really useful at times. But we want to have lots and lots and lots of them. We're going to do it through the semantic web. We're going to do it, and we are doing it through blogs and web pages and everything else that has links in them. And links are incredibly. If you want to find the existing semantic web, look at the look at the web of semantic links. I mean, links are semantic. Do constitute a semantic web. Unfortunately, it's a sort of wild one. But, so we're going to do it over and over and over for generations. We're going to do it through playlists for books, for movies, for songs, for course syllabi. We're going to continue doing it through sites like Dig and Reddit and the hundreds of others that are going to emerge, where instead of the decision about what gets pulled together on the front page being made by a bunch of white men in an airless room, we're going to do it for ourselves. We're already doing it. We're all already reading the news socially on the web, right? So we're going to do it. We're going to do it that way as well. We're going to make these connections endlessly through hyperlinks. We're just going to keep doing this. We're going to keep building meaning, and every time we connect two things for ourselves or for others, we're adding to the meaning of this of the world that we've created for ourselves. We are not going to stop knowing. We are way too good at knowing. We are so good at knowing. We know how to do it. We know how to validate it. We know how to communicate it. Knowing is not at risk. I know to some classes of people it looks like the internet in general is the death of knowledge. Bullshit. We are going to keep knowing no matter what. We're just going to keep getting better at it. But it's not the only thing we're doing, and it's not clear to me that now it is obviously the most important thing that we do, that it's the most important relationship we have with the world is the knowledge-based one. Because now we have a generational task, and we've taken it up. It's a multi-generational task, which is to build meaning. And it's in meaning, by building these relationships, which is a new platform for meaning, and it's in meaning that knowledge gets its place. It's how knowledge becomes understanding. And understanding, knowledge is only capable of a singular in English, but understanding, that's plural. Lots of understandings, and the world is better for lots of understandings. We get that through embedding knowledge and meaning. It's also how knowledge turns into hope. Thanks. Thank you. By the way, because of the jokey beginning, I didn't actually get to say something seriously, which is, it is actually a huge honor to be able to talk with you. And this has been a fantastic conference, so thank you. Oh. I think we don't or do have time for questions. We started a little late. I don't know whose hide that comes out of, though. Okay, good.
I'm Veland on the English Wikipedia, and I run one of the bots that helps with cleanup. I just to say about tags like NPOV and cleanup and stuff like that, like the New York Times editorial process is obviously very different from the Wikipedia editorial process in that they're putting out a finished product. And like if you look at the articles that are tagged for cleanup, they're not finished products. Wikipedia is a work in progress. And like the fact that even neutrality is something which is a little weird because it comes and goes. Like, we might think it's fixed, and then it turns out it's not, which is true in any editorial process, whether it's finished or not. But, like, for the New York Times, it's kind of like, all right, if there's a glaring error in your article, then you sit down and you have a meeting with your editor, and you fix it, and you declare it done, and then you put it out. That's kind of the serious reason why, I think.
Well, and it's in part it's the nature of the physical medium. Printing is... we all know this, right? Printing has a cutoff date, and then it's public, and it's very hard to change. It's also, in some regimes, embarrassing to change, or to bury the changes. So the point is not that every Wikipedia article ought to carry My point is simply that the willingness of Wikipedia to advertise, to alert readers to the imperfection of its own articles, mm-hmm. goes a long way to giving readers a proper sense that that Wikipedia is a trustable source.
That's true.
It's not completely trustable.
Right.
And New York Times's failure. So New York Times gets things to a state where they think it's right, but sometimes they're wrong.
Right.
For example, for a year when before the Iraq War. Mm-hmm. So once that becomes exposed and they have to actually apologize for a year's worth of bad reporting, as they did, that hurts their credibility. Whereas Wikipedia, because it's along the way, is willing to say, we're not sure we're getting this right, maybe you can help, increases their credibility.
Yeah, so that's why they have a correction section.
Yes, that's why they have a correction section.
Thank you for that presentation. I think you've really put it in tremendous context for me. And I run a company that puts an online encyclopedia up with almost 3 million entries now. And I'm always having this argument on my board where one of the board members, Bela Hadvani, is always saying, knowledge is consensus belief. And it seems to me that sort of sums up a lot of what you're talking about. And what a lot of the transition and difficulty is that consensus is changing. And so the context is always in question. And so the consensus that represents Wikipedia is one that is defined and examined and is actually self-examined, which is especially valuable. But each context has its own sense of credibility. So people come to Harvard to go to school because it has this established credibility of what society has given it, a sense of consensus that then puts belief as an important element. So I don't know if that strikes any comment.
At the risk of just being ornery, I would amend that to say that knowledge, for me, can't simply be consensus belief, because then there's no difference between mass. Then you're in Stephen Colbert territory, right? But we are incredibly sophisticated because we have spent literally thousands of years figuring out how to know stuff, how to know stuff about God, how to know stuff about gnats, how to know stuff about what TV program to watch. We're really good at it, and the ways that we have of doing it are complex, they're subtle, we usually cannot explain everything about them, and many of those ways, maybe not so much for TV programs, but for NAT, have something, just for purposes of argument, let's call it objective. They have objective correlates, or things you can do. So it's not, consensus belief for me is not the sum of it, although the question is, do we have good ways of getting to consensus? And generally we do. So,
I would like to suggest another model for thinking about convergence of meaning and the influence of meanings in the social sciences. I should suggest that as Wikipedia progresses, physical sciences may arrive at unitarian meanings, but in the social sciences and humanities, we may find a multiplication of meanings and more meanings added over time, such that there may be dozens of points of view about how to talk about society or gender or race and these sorts of things. And that as we move into the future, we won't find that we come to an agreement about how to talk about those things, but we'll add new layers of meaning, and so that we can't really think of social, scientific, and humanities sorts of meanings as ever being able to be externalized, but only multiplied in our number of interpretations.
So you see a forking sort of methodology between the humanities and the sciences?
I see that we may need different methodologies to deal with having dozens of different meanings. We may need to have many more sub-articles.
And
those sub-articles may have within them multiplications of meanings and variants of meanings. I don't know if we can concretize meanings and come to consensus on these, as much as have ongoing dialogues which change with every generation due to revolutions in the way we understand.
Yeah. So the article on Jerusalem obviously is going to be under more editorial contention and may need multiple entries as opposed to the one on cobalt.
We may never converge. We may have an endless diversion.
Yeah. All that I would say is I think this is more of a continuum than a break, that the article on cobalt actually is going to be in contention forever, just as the periodic table is one representation but not the only representation of elements. It's not, you know, not to say that it's a wrong representation, but there are other useful ones. So, for example, earth scientists like a different sort of periodic table, apparently. I will alternate sides. Yes.
This is a little open-ended. I just wanted to know your thoughts on a quote by Charles Van Doren, I believe an encyclopedist. He said that the purpose of an encyclopedia is primarily to teach and only secondarily to inform. I was wondering what you thought on that.
That's great.
Thanks.
the notion that those two things are, that there is such a thing as informing as opposed to teaching, is itself revelatory.
So one of the things that you described in Small Pieces Loosely Joined was a kind of cottage industry of knowledge that built up with the web. Evan's page about submarines, Dave's shrine to Pamela Anderson, just a world of very disparate, replicated knowledge. I wonder what your feeling is about the relationship of that world of knowledge with Wikipedia. How has the world of Wikipedia influenced the greater web and the knowledge stored there?
I thought the other one was open-ended. Oh. So on the one hand, you can see the commoditization of knowledge, which I think is a very healthy and good thing, occurring as more and more sites, say blogs or wherever, use a term that they think their readers may not know, and so what's the default link site? Wikipedia. You know, you may not even have to read the Wikipedia, the author may not even read the Wikipedia page, but is confident that, yeah, you want to know, you know, this link there, which I think is a really good thing. So it's serving a particular referential role. However, I can't imagine that the highly point of view, highly voiced expressions of topics is ever going to be subsumed by, I don't have to write about about my opinions about the World Trade Center because that's covered in Wikipedia. That's never going to happen, which is also, this is also a good thing. So, I hope the cottage industry is going to keep going and become, you know, mass industry, you know, be what we all do, with the Wikipedia serving as a particular type of reference for here's what we agree upon. You know, this other stuff, I don't know if you agree with me about the World Trade Center, but in here I have a link to the Statue of Liberty. You know, you can agree on this because it's in Wikipedia. I've lost
last five questions.
Okay.
I don't know if you've read Ian Stewart and Jack Cohen's books at all.
Let's say no.
Okay. It seems to me that the word he has coined dovetails nicely with what you talked about here. He calls it extelligence. As an inverse of intelligence, meaning the outside knowledge, the meaning, as you put it.
Yeah, well, that's... I haven't read it. Sounds like a useful phrase. But I can't use it because it's his.
Your seven frameworks really are wonderfully provocative. I'm still struggling to put a couple of them together. Right, the knowledge depends on who says it. But the knowledge seems to depend what is in your head then. And therefore, I think, or I wonder where you see the role of responsibility for those who express knowledge that may be false, partially false, or misleading, and for harmful knowledge or harmful expressions. Doesn't the responsibility have to be tied? Don't we have to see the attribution? Don't we need to make the connection with who did it?
The notion that it's in... So, first of all, make sure I'm not being misleading, and I will be fast. Right? The notion that knowledge is not in our heads, but is something social, and depends upon large institutions, which... as well as can be developed in conversation and dispute, does not mean that individuals have no role and no responsibility. It's, I think I'm simply describing, as many before me have, what we all know. Right? The question of responsibility is enormously complicated, to which we have already developed enormously complicated and usually suitable responses. So we have a whole bunch of laws that cover one type of responsibility, and we have the moment at which you're on the IRC when somebody is being racist, you have the moment at which it's okay for you to come forward and say, you know, you're really sounding racist. The first three times you did it, I thought maybe you're just being funny, but you're really sounding racist. There's no written code for that, but there is a norm. And so we have everything from norms to criminal codes and Wikipedia policies to try to handle the responsibility issue. So there is not a simple answer except to say responsibility doesn't go away just because knowledge isn't our...
I think it's really important to make it explicit and apparent. And it enriches the quality of what's there and protects us all when we attribute and make responsible.
I actually deeply disagree with you.
Okay.
I think anonymity is a default in the real world and should be the default online, except the default obviously means there are cases where no... but anonymity is enormously freeing.
I'd love that debate. We'll take
okay.
it up.
But probably not now.
Okay. Last question?
I was wondering how you, in the framework that you established, you would compare the Wikimedia or Wiki framework to older non-electronic style frameworks that exist in the past. I was thinking, for example, of the Talmud.
Others have... there's a book which I actually thought was a little disappointing except in the title, which is The Internet and the Talmud. Is that what it's called? Which sort of makes this case, and Adina Levin also has made it. And you can, if you don't know Adina, you should, and you can Google her. The point is that the Talmud is this a text, a central text that is assumed to be authoritative and unchanging, surrounded and physically surrounded in the way that it's produced with commentary. And the commentary is conversational, it's back and forth, and has its own sort of authority, a sort of weird sort of authority that Jews spend a lot of time trying to interpret. So I think there are lots of points of, I don't know, similarity of contact between what's going on now and what happened in the Talmud, and I think there's actually a whole bunch to learn from it, including the willingness to accept the unfinished nature of knowledge. It is conversation. It's not going to stop. It's not that one of the rabbi wins and everybody else has to shut up. In fact, there's very explicit commentary and stories quite to the opposite. In fact, when it's God who wins and the rabbis won't shut up. So there's a lot to learn there about the continuing conversation, the unfinished, this necessarily unfinished nature of knowledge, and yet the ability to learn from the process by which the conversation goes forward, which sounds like not such a bad description of Wikipedia, so long as we don't equate Jimmy Wales with the God figure.
Another round of applause. Let me tell you what the plan is for the rest of today. We are going to be meeting back here in 10 minutes, so please don't leave the room. You can grab drinks or something to eat back there. But we're going to be coming back. We're going to be showing the winners of the media contest. We're going to be giving away stuff. We're going to be summarizing the sessions for the last 3 days. So please stay in here. Come back in 10 minutes to your seats. Thanks.